Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
This is Alicia Linden, author of The ABM Effect, How to Win, Retain, and Grow Valuable Clients for Market-Beating Growth. And you are listening to the Marketing Book Podcast.
Welcome to the Marketing Book Podcast, helping you keep up with the smartest thinking in the quickly changing field of modern marketing. And now, here's your host, Douglas Burdett.
Hello, thanks for joining me on the Marketing Book Podcast, where every Friday I publish an interview with the author of a new marketing or sales book. This show has been named one of the top marketing podcasts by Forbes and LinkedIn, amongst others, and has millions of downloads and listeners in over 185 countries. Don't worry about taking notes. You can find links to everything linkable in this episode's website page at marketingbookpodcast.com. And since I get to read every book featured on the show, if I can recommend a specific marketing or sales book or any other resource I know of for whatever challenge you're facing, connect and message me on LinkedIn, and I will do my best to get you pointed in the right direction. All right, let's get on with the show. Today, we welcome Alicia Linden to talk about her book, The ABM Effect, How to Win, Retain, and Grow Valuable Clients for Market-Beating Growth. Alicia Linden pioneered the idea of account-based marketing to drive growth in strategic accounts. She is the chief executive at Momentum ITSMA, which she founded in 2011, advising global technology, professional, and financial services firms on growth strategies, key account development, and team alignment. Prior to Momentum ITSMA, Alicia spent 10 years in growth roles at technology firms, including Microsoft. Alicia is also the host of the Account-Based Marketing Podcast, is a regular contributor to Forbes, and is a speaker on growth topics. And, interesting fact, she is living in the fourth house she designed herself. Alicia, congratulations on the ABM Effect, and welcome to the Marketing Book Podcast.
Doug, fantastic to be with you. Really looking forward to the conversation.
I am too, and the topic of your book, account-based marketing, is one of my favorite subjects and is really popular with the listeners based on the number of times they contact me and ask me to recommend a book on account-based marketing. So I will now be able to send this interview along to them as well. And I recently interviewed Bev Burgess about her book, Account-Based Growth, which was just excellent. And I've interviewed Dave Munn twice about the book he authored with Bev, A Practitioner's Guide to Account-Based Marketing. And so that was the first and second edition. And I will include links to those interviews on this episode's website page at marketingbookpodcast.com. Now, a little bit of background. Momentum, your firm, acquired ITSMA in 2021. Is that right?
That's right. Yes, we both came together, a very complementary business. I mean, we have been working with clients in strategic client growth programs, helping establish ABM disciplines, and ITSMA, a long-standing membership community of ABM professionals, marketing professionals, and also provided the market-leading certification and learning capabilities for account-based marketing practitioners. So really the coming together of our consulting and content business together with ITSMA's learning business and community has really been a fantastic journey for us, and you know, hugely valuable for our clients who are typically looking to build culture, build capability, and drive change. And to do those things, you need different disciplines, and you need to be able to assemble different expertise. And we've got a phenomenal team, and great clients that we're able to partner to do exactly that.
And after I posted a picture of your book on LinkedIn, I I started noticing a lot of, ITSMA certified people coming out of the woodwork. Yes. Great.
Over 3,000 people we've now certified, and probably just over in the last 18 months, just over half of those have happened. So really reaching peak levels of certification, and we've launched a number of other learning solutions as a result, so integrated account development. More on the sales side as well, given this is a combined effort. It takes a village, right?
Yes, and I think this is an exciting time to be involved in that. So now Dave Munn was, I guess, the president of ITSMA, something like that.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So Dave Munn is basically your employee, is that right?
No, we're teammates. Dave's a great member of our team. He's a partner with the firm. We're a small global team, so I try not to keep any hierarchy, and absolutely love working with Dave.
Yeah, but if he gets out of line, I mean, let's be honest. Now, listen, one thing I have to say about Dave is, did you know that he ran with the Bulls at Pamplona?
Yes. Yes, yes. We recounted that story many a times. I've known that for a little while now.
Well, I don't want to tell you how to run your firm, but if I were you, I'd keep an eye on that guy, because he's clearly a big risk taker.
Between the bull chasing and his mountain biking.
Yes, yes.
And his adrenaline sports.
But I think that if I may have the story wrong, but he may have been running with the Bulls to impress his wife, who I think at the time he might have been dating. So, Jennifer married him and probably settled him and civilized him down. So, well, listen, enough about Dave Munn. I'm sure he'll never come back on the show now. But I noticed the book has U.S. or American spellings rather than the British spellings. Don't think I don't notice these things, Alicia.
I mean, many of our clients and, a lot of the relationships, so I spend half my time in our Boston office. About half our team is based in North America, but the majority of our clients and our relationships are in North America. I adopted a slightly bizarre way and approach to write this book, which is to do it through audio, so given my experience with podcasting. I had wanted to work on this project for a little while and ended up just dedicating every weekend for about 4 months recording via audio and then going back and doing the transcript and then the text edit.
Oh, interesting.
Off the back end of it. So you'll probably, as you're reading the book, it's sometimes people say it's like having a conversation with me, because it was very much a conversation in the way that I set out to do it.
Yeah.
That approach worked for me in the time blocks that I had.
That explains something. It was very, it was a very quick read, and it reminds me of a book. There are speakers who have been on the show, people who make a living as speakers as well as other things, and they always have good books. And I think it's because they've had to communicate that information to audiences, and they've gotten feedback. It's like a comedian refining their act over the years. And I remember Joey Coleman, who's been on a couple times, he went into a audio booth and recorded the first draft of his book in like 12 hours, and that formed the basis.
Wow.
So it's interesting. Sounds like a kind of a similar story. But I did notice you use the word soccer in the book, so that was the big tell for me. So anyway, enough about that. Now listen, I do have an extra copy of the book, which I'm happy to send to a listener. I will send it to a listener who shares this interview on LinkedIn and tags us so as to get my attention. Now,
fabulous.
Very impressively, the foreword is written by Don Peppers, who is the co-author of the 1993 book, The One-to-One Future, which is widely credited with having launched the CRM revolution. And Inc. Magazine's editor-in-chief called it one of the two or three most important business books ever written. And I have a copy of the book on my bookshelf. And I believe I read it around 1997, and it's been mentioned in other books that have been on the show over the years. And I just love the end of his foreword, where he wrote, "Account-based marketing can be a truly demanding task, but in the end, it's still just common sense."
I mean, Don's fantastic and very, he was actually the first person to read the full book before writing his foreword. So I really loved his summary, and it's been great. We had a launch event in Boston 12 months or so ago, 14 months now, And it was just great spending time with him.
Well, congratulations.
To also meet him, you know, like the world goes round full circle. So,
yeah. Yeah,
great collaboration. I felt like anyone that I wanted to partner with on this book, and I was racking my brains as to who in my ideal world would write the foreword.
Yeah.
You know, should it be one of our team? Is it one of our clients? You know, who else would add an interesting lens to this? And having done agreed to write the foreword was really poetic, and you know, it's certainly for me a personal highlight, career highlight, to get the opportunity to partner
absolutely
and collaborate with Don in this way.
Yes, that's a really big deal.
Yeah. Okay. Should I tell you a funny story though?
Yeah, sure.
At the launch party in Boston, Don mentioned that his son has just got a new job. And his son is now an account-based marketeer.
Oh, really?
At a consumer goods company. So he just couldn't believe it. I mean, his son went into marketing, but to have been appointed as an ABM practitioner in a role as he was announcing the kind of launch of this book.
Was wow.
Really poetic timing. Yeah.
I bet he's very, very proud. Now, the question is, was Dave Munn at that party?
He was, yes. Dave was there. We toasted the book. We had a lot of fun.
But did he behave?
He was good, yeah. He was good.
Okay, I'm just saying, you got to keep an eye on that guy.
He's not going to come back now. He's not going to come back.
Okay. I don't know. I might be able to go to Jennifer and say, Jennifer, come on, third edition, please come back. So I want to quote from a couple sections of the introduction here, just to set the stage. Let's see. I'm going to pull out a few sections. Page 5, many sales and marketing teams focus on what they sell and don't put enough emphasis on understanding what's going on with their client's business and figuring out where they can add the most value. This book provides a strategy that helps organizations to treat clients as markets of one, making the most of client insights to build tailored value propositions and develop specific engagement strategies. And then on to the next page, when navigating buying cycles, there's a significant need for organizational alignment, and this starts with a common understanding of how clients buy. I've written this book for executives and sales and marketing leaders to develop a shared understanding of the role they play across the buying cycle, identify barriers to purchase, and address the needs of their clients before, during, and after the buying cycle. This book aims to serve as a guide for executives who want to embrace the strategic importance of expanding business with their most valuable clients. And finally, the next page. It shows how you can create a win-win for your firm and your clients, support and enable client buying processes, meet clients where they are, and address key moments in an enterprise buying process, earn your reputation with strategic clients, learn the behaviors needed to build trust and leverage client insight, and sharpen client focus leading to growth, unpack complex buying cycles from hundreds of engagements, identify where clients are, and know when to act in accounts. And then just one other thing from page 11 just jumped off the page and warmed the cockles of my heart. Page 11, far too many sales and marketing teams are focused on what they want to sell and don't put enough emphasis on understanding what's going on with their clients' business so they can figure it out and show them where they can add the most value.
Can you dig it? Can you dig it?
You didn't know that your book get someone that excited, but you did. You did.
Fantastic. I'm glad. Really glad that hit the mark, resonated.
There were several throughout the book, but I'll spare you and the audience. So before we go further, I wanted you to touch on the CBX study you did that you referenced throughout the book. Some of that information was just amazing, and we're going to come back to it. But if you could tell us about that study.
Yeah, sure. I mean, we spent the last 12 years or so kind of knee deep in strategic clients and figuring out how these organizations buy. So if you take somebody like Bank of America versus a Wells Fargo, you know, how they make decisions is very different. How they come to a buying process, how they treat their providers, how they interact with each other in terms of their culture. And a lot of that knowledge and information is often aligned to a client engagement, and it's difficult for us to share from one client to the next. So we commissioned the CBX engagement, which is the Client Buying Index, probably 9 years ago now. And on top of that, we've augmented some former ITSMA data that is spans two decades, mm-hmm. and really focuses on how senior CXO buyers in these large firms are approaching investment decisions and what sales and marketing strategies are really cutting through. We run a pulse on a rolling basis. So we are talking to the Global 2000, interviewing the Global 2000 for different types of high value purchase decisions. And it really helps us to spot trends and figure out and really codify some of that fantastic tacit knowledge that we've picked up in organizations like I've just described with Bank of America versus a Wells Fargo, and help add value in the work we do as well.
Well, I'm going to come back to that a few other times in our conversation here. I want to step back, though. On page 11, you write that lots of B2B industry pundits predicted that nobody was ever going to focus on just one client. They asked why anyone would focus on speaking to one company or account when they could develop the same campaign and market to a broader set of accounts. This is your crazy pills moment. Do you still encounter that mindset?
Not so much now. And I think particularly in the last couple of years, business has accelerated in terms of this coming to realize actually cost of acquisition and chasing new logos is that really the answer, and how much of this effort is really paying off. I think organizations like Forrester and Gartner have long been quoting how many leads in B2B marketing actually convert to become closed won revenue, and 4 or 5 years ago that figure was 3%. Now it's sub 1% in their data, and I think with a lot of the market, great to see this kind of shift away from expecting complex B2B to just be a linear process and not this kind of knotty spaghetti buying process. and I think this, I remember distinctly sitting down with a publisher, it was 11 years ago, on the marketing side. And he just said to me, this is never going to take off. I can go and take that same amount of budget and spend it on an entire industry. Why would I just pursue one account? And the kind of critical nature of these integrated key accounts, strategic accounts, they're driving the vast majority of business for lots of firms. That's been it's been an evolution over time to get to. But I think we're making really good headway. Even small businesses, who I know make up some of your listener base, that they're seeing actually growing these big whales is transformative for their business, and it's entirely possible to do. And equally, large firms, just winning the next logo isn't a way to sustained growth and really to outperform the market. You have to sharpen your focus on clients, and having this more integrated sales and marketing approach is a great way of getting there. So don't encounter this kind of disbelief, if you will, as much anymore. I think we're now in a place where the concept of account-based marketing has been thrown around for so long that it means many different things to different people, and really going back to first principles is a point that I have to keep repeating in many conversations.
So old dogs can learn new tricks. I am so glad to hear that.
Yeah, no, because the market's definitely evolved. I mean, yeah. We're really super excited about lots of conversations and the way the market's thinking. I think the challenge, even at a senior executive level, is being clear on the role of marketing and anchoring everything back in how clients are buying, what are the needs of those clients and accounts.
Yeah.
It's becoming more and more central, I think, to lots of growth strategies. Even product-based businesses, we're seeing them shift to more client orientation of going to market with their customers, which is what it's all about, right? And sometimes it's easy to lose sight of that when you've got double-digit growth with your phenomenal R&D and innovation. But actually, when markets evolve like a market we're in now, it's all about and the focus has to be all on your customers.
Well, that doesn't mean the words spray and pray were not included in your book. But that wasn't a section on what not to do, which we'll get to. I want to jump ahead to the buyer. The darn buyers, you write that, I think it was on 19, you write that, strangely, the single biggest challenge of selling today is not the actual selling, but that clients are struggling to buy. Talk about the changes going on in the buying process and what that's actually the problem they have. They want to buy, but it's just becoming so difficult.
Yeah, I mean, we've seen lots of macro changes just generally. If you think about society, we're less trusting. It's harder to build connection. You know, there's a lot that's changed in the last few years. And as you look to how organizations are operating, you know, many working in hybrid settings, they're not really geared and set up for this level of remote working either. So as it relates to decision making and the way that they build consensus as this plays out to the whole provider and customer relationship, you know, trust is on the decline. Mm-hmm. Significantly. Mm-hmm. So one of the things we see in our data, you know, 3 or 4 years ago, the number of trusted providers was, you know, on average 5. That's dropped to less than 3.
Yes.
So, you know, big decline in trust. And all of this stems to it's having a big impact in buying processes. There's more confusion in the markets and, you know, more people who feel like they have a say, harder to get to consensus and agreement at every stage of that buying process. And therefore buying is becoming more and more challenging. You know, we're seeing buying processes drop off partway through, projects getting canned, even, you know, in entire initiatives changing focus through that buying process. So I think a lot of this is about ways of working, broader culture, market, and the number of adjacent solutions and services to solve that same problem just keeps on growing. So really, buyer knowledge and awareness and being able to filter out, you know, are we comparing apples and apples here, or are these different things?
Yeah, you know, that was one of the most surprising things from the study that you mentioned in your book, where you talk about the emerging trends in today's enterprise buying cycles. They want innovation. They have a thirst for innovation, the buying committees. Mm-hmm. They want more agile buying committees, which is difficult because they keep growing. But the third one was they want trusted partners. And this is what just really amazed me, is that surprisingly, like you said, surprisingly few providers are trusted partners, even though that's what, you know, the partners aspire to be.
Yeah.
But and like you said, not to put too fine a point on it, 80% of enterprises say they have 3 or fewer trusted advisors. Do you think that, or do you find that a lot of vendors think, oh no, we're more trusted than that? Do you think there's a disconnect between what the vendors are thinking and versus what I just said the buyers are thinking?
I mean, there's definitely a bit of rose-tinted view of, yes, I've got a great relationship and therefore I'm trusted. I always use the analogy of, you know, trust is earned in droplets and lost in bucket loads, and I referenced it.
Great quote, yeah.
In the book as well, as something that I heard through the work that we do as well. That's the piece that when you really dig into it, nobody's really got a handle on that. Actually, you might have had a great interaction, but these subsequent 3 interactions have ended up depleting trust in that relationship. So I think part of the challenge, particularly with for large organizations with big customers, is this idea that somebody owns that client relationship, and it's a singular client relationship or a binary one. In actual fact, that client is interacting with your organization, with other team members, be it through self-service or direct relationships all the time. And how do you make sure that every single one of those interactions is driving consistency and helping to build those tiny droplets of trust in every interaction itself?
That was another point that just jumped off the pages at me, that so many companies, there's nobody who owns the buying process. Mm-hmm. And that was a better way of articulating why I've had over 70 books on the show about sales, because I'm always saying that, you know, the more that marketers understand about what the salespeople are doing, what their challenges are, but more importantly, the buying process, the more effective they're going to be as marketing. And here's a book that is an affirmation for me. Again, I'm sorry, you just had no idea how emotionally involved some of your readers are getting. Either that, or there was a certain crazy pill element to your book where I'm thinking, yes, yes, don't take my word for it. Look, she knows this thing.
Very good. I'm glad. Yeah. It's obviously the writing style or the way that it landed in the end. Glad it resonated.
Probably all. Yeah, and this conversation, this book, it's just turned into a wonderful support group. for me. Thank you, Alicia. You did have no idea you're probably also a therapist.
I always feel like, safe space and always good to thrash it out.
Oh, well, I think it's chapter 3. It delves into the chaos across buying cycles. And as I mentioned earlier, you've designed 4 houses that you lived in. So you clearly are a person that loves chaos. And it talks about how you navigate the buying cycles. It's like the game of snakes and ladders. Or some people may call it chutes and ladders. Mm-hmm. And I just want to mention what they are real quickly. So we're not going to go into all of them, but you, and this will sound familiar to a lot of listeners. There are 5 stages of the buying cycle, as you articulated. Stage 1 is the epiphany, recognizing the need to change the status quo. And stage 2 is awareness, where they're clarifying the issues and identifying alternatives. Stage 3 is interest, where they're evaluating possible solutions. Stage 4 is confidence, selecting a way forward. And the 5th is reality, post-purchase evaluation, which I see a lot of companies just skip completely. Mm-hmm. And you, but there's another very important part there. You mentioned that there are 2 gates that buying teams need to go through at each one of those 5 stages. One is getting agreement from the buying team. In other words, do we all agree? And the other is getting validation. Are we still doing the right thing? And you then go on to say that, you know, all buying processes are different. But I wanted to talk about what works, because I know the listeners are thinking, well, ours is a little different. Okay, I hear you. You're right. Yeah, they're all a little bit different, but those 5 are a very good framework. But I want to talk about what works always. And I want to mention the first one, which is on, page 35, I think. Yeah, page 35, which made me chuckle. You said, these are the things that always work. And number 1 was give buyers credit. They can and do read, watch, and listen to content.
I think there's often a sense that they don't know anything or they haven't consumed anything and or they won't consume this content, therefore we've got to do something different. And, you know, with lots of marketing, particularly in the B2B space, that ends up becoming an event. And actually, if it's high quality thought leadership, if it's insight based, if it's relevant, that they're going to spend time reading it. And particularly when you look at the average amount of time, I don't know, Douglas, how much time you're spending on essentially marketing content or supplier content. I certainly spend in excess of the hours per week, if I rack them all up, on the train, in an airport, you're constantly consuming content from providers. So content matters.
As it relates to the content, you say, our research suggests that high quality thought leadership is one of the most critical factors in driving trust and confidence with clients. But then you say, but what exactly do clients mean by thought leadership? Thought leadership seems like one of those terms that's often used, but not always really well understood. What do you mean by that?
Yeah. I mean, for me, it's about being original. It's about having some form of evidence base and a perspective that is helping you to ultimately build reputation and drive some form of new idea or innovation. There's lots of people that say we want to do thought leadership and it ends up being the same thing that's been said 20 different times. And there may be 1 or 2 word changes, but that's not value for clients. Clients want to hear what's next. What should they be thinking about? They want to hear, you know, things that they're facing, you know, how have other clients overcome those areas, what's new and emerging, what's potentially going to shape their roles and their businesses. And you can only really get to that by having some form of evidence base. So going out on social media and having a kind of a strong perspective or just regurgitating what you've read or seen somewhere else, you know, in my mind, that's not original thought. That's not a value exchange for clients, and I wouldn't include that in the thought leadership category of what clients find valuable, particularly during buying processes.
Yeah, don't expect ChatGPT to write your thought leadership content. And we're laughing to keep from crying, I know. But I know that one of the most important words that I just heard was evidence. And it brings to mind a book that was on the show a couple of years ago by Bob Boudet, and I'm going to include a link to that interview, called Competing on Thought Leadership. And it was very much about how you need to incorporate the evidence. What have you found, either with your own research or with your own clients? So it's the kind of thing that you see throughout your book. I want to jump ahead to, well, we talked about, you know, people do consume content. And this was another very important one that, again, just jumped out at me. Number three was include both digital and human touches in the buyer's journey. And I want to quote from that page and ask you to say more about this, because I think this may surprise a lot of folks. And if I could generalize, I wonder if it's more prevalent amongst younger people. There is an emphasis on buying activity in the digital space. The logic goes something like this. Since so much of the buying process, from initial research through to supplier selection, happens online, we have to make it easy for buyers. While this line of thinking is not necessarily wrong, I believe the dominance of digital channels has been overstated. Mm-hmm. Talk about that. Take a stand, Alicia.
Yeah, sure. I mean, my view is that there's a lot of focus, a lot of energy that goes in, and the thought is all this buying is happening, you know, whether it's 50% or 80% of the buying process has concluded before you even talk to a seller. And actually, when we dig into the data and we dig into these high-value purchases, that human touch is just as critical. And actually, through all the stages, it's pretty equal. It's kind of 50-50. And a big part of that is, if you go to look at a paid advert on some kind of publisher site, or you look at an email or a web page, you're not going to suddenly click on that page and place a $500,000, a $10 million order. It's not a transaction. Certainly those are the types of buying processes that we're digging into. And it's, whilst yes, you can do a lot of research, a big part of that research is having human consultative conversations, and ties back into the thought leadership discussion we were just having. You've got to be able to join the dots between what is the challenge and what are some potential solutions, and quite often that requires some level of human connect to be able to do that. So our data shows that across that the buying process, and it does come as a surprise given how much marketing focus is on those digital channels, that at least half is happening through human interactions, and we shouldn't undervalue those human interactions. I mean, people buy from people, right? So we shouldn't underweight those or design everything to be digital. I also think there's just so many propositions that are not a click and buy. You know, you're not buying coffee cups, and it's not a small business buying them quite often. It's a large account looking to buy something quite complex or quite custom for their business.
Yes, that was in the book where you say, look, you buy coffee mugs. Okay, that's different from what we're talking about in this book. And it reminds me of something we always said to clients, which was, look, the purpose of all this online is to get offline. In most instances. And there was even a book on the show recently by Julie Atherton on B2B social selling strategy. And in that book, she makes it really clear, no one ever bought a locomotive from a tweet.
No.
It's just one element of it. And that's why another great quote here is from page 33. You say, those who know when and where human interaction in the buying process is required are the ones we see winning. One other thing I want to ask you about is about, from page 46, team selling. And you write that executives can be a huge asset to selling teams during buying cycles. Do you find that key executives, top executives, are being underutilized or don't want to be involved?
The dynamic's really shifted. We've gone definitely from a place of ivory tower, big disconnect between executives and customers in the main. And it's not there are exceptions and have been exceptions to that. As virtual and hybrid selling has become the norm, it's now very easy to gain access to executives, i.e. jumping on a 30-minute Zoom is a lot easier than flying halfway across the world to host a meeting with all the prep that is then needed for that to happen. What that's done is put a lot of pressure on executives to show up during the buying cycle and certainly show up in the right moments of a client relationship. I think it's definitely on the up, and we're seeing a lot more executive engagement in integrated account development and these clients and overall marketing effort. There's much more focus on executive engagement and how do you really show up in a meaningful way. I think the challenge is, you know, lots of execs are also subject matter experts. They have their own domain, and they don't necessarily feel like natural customer people, so they're not thinking from the client perspective. And it goes back to that chaos that we were touching on earlier. How do you make sure that the executive is equipped with the knowledge to have a really valuable conversation, but also i.e. customer knowledge and context? And then how is that executive equipped to create some value? You know, we're in an age of customer collaboration, and that collaboration should be one of giving something to the customer that's valuable as many times as possible. It doesn't have to be a paid for service, be it a piece of advice, be it a connection that you're making. And not all execs are equipped to do these things, but firms that are really getting this right are the ones that are succeeding and really sustaining growth as well.
So I interview authors about books, so there's a lot of them on my mind. And there was another one. In other words, throughout your book, I can think, there's a whole book about like this one particular topic.
Yes.
Yeah, and there's a one that was on recently, and it's already a Wall Street Journal bestseller by Scott Edinger, and it's called The Growth Leader. And the reason I asked that question is because in his book, he takes aim squarely at CEOs because they have this research that shows just how unengaged they are with the sales effort of their company.
Yeah.
I'll include a link to that interview because that was very important. And for me, it brought to mind a prospect I was talking to years ago, big company. I was talking to the marketing folks about if we were going to be able to help them solve certain problems. And they mentioned there was a sales, you know, global sales meeting coming up. You know, they were going to fly people in. And I asked some sort of question about the CEO. What are the priorities and so forth? And they said, he doesn't attend the sales meetings. And I remember thinking, what the hell does he do? So anyway,
you definitely are going to check out that episode. Sounds like a really good one, and I should read that book as well. I think it's evolving, and yeah, it's certainly, you know, 5-7 years ago, the idea was build a sales team and the sales team will sell. We're seeing now actually organizations that weren't as customer centric, that they're having to really lean in show up in a way that other competitors are showing up as well. So it's definitely the age of CEOs leaning into the sales process and leaning into their
business. And last time I checked the news, they're not underpaid. So I'm sorry. Get to work, you people. I want to jump ahead to, again, one of my favorite topics about which there are too few books written. There have been a couple on the show, but it's sales and marketing alignment, which this is one of the things I love about ABM is it almost sneaks sales and marketing alignment into an organization. So however it works, however, you know, the rising tide. But I wanted to quote from page 49, because this is such great advice for marketers in their career. This one paragraph, which also explains, again, why I've had so many books about sales on the show. You're right. I've always believed a best-in-class marketing team is not one that focuses on communications and brand alone. Marketing done well should be the voice of the customer, analyzing the needs of clients, why they buy, what's stopping them from buying, and what they need before, during, and after a buying cycle.
Can you dig it?
Talk to me about how our sales and marketing teams responding to the changes in this this ever-evolving buying cycle.
Yeah, sure. I mean, I think for a long time there's been this focus on there's some brand building activities over here, and there's some demand gen activities over happening over there, and one is about capturing near-term demand, and you're getting opportunities into the top of the funnel.
Yeah, top of the funnel. That was a big point. Yeah.
Into the sales process, and away we go. It's going to become revenue. And then the brand piece is about long-term, you know, that's where the next big business is going to come from. And so you've got this rally going on, or baton passing between sales and marketing with this kind of lead generation approach. The great thing about focusing on accounts, focusing on clients, is that it should anchor you in a common objective, a common set of metrics, a common goal of where you need to get to. And what that should then mean is that you're driving marketing activity that's building both mental and physical availability. And by mental availability, it's that reputation. It's making sure that these accounts remember you. So when they do have that challenge or they're in a particular situation, you're remembered for the right things and the right reasons, and there's that connection. And then the kind of physical availability is where they are already in a live buying cycle and you're helping to facilitate that buying process. I think sales and marketing alignment is often a hotly debated topic because those two skill sets are often cut from very different cloths. I think the best aligned teams are those that are obsessed about clients and customers. They're the ones that are really focused on those customer needs, and you don't have one sat in a room that is in service of the other. They're really working to build their skill sets. So if you think about big accounts and what it takes to grow big accounts, it's about building, you know, fantastic relationships, deepening those relationships and across those accounts into other buying groups, you know, across different buying levels. It's about building great commercial structures and having a direction of travel for this, for each customer, of where do you want to get them to, what's the North Star, and where can you add the most value. And the third piece is around being able to articulate your value through the customer's lens.
Oh, yes.
And those three skill areas are not a sales only or a marketing only skill set, right? So the combination is where the magic happens. And that integration, and touching on your point of Don Pepper's saying it's just common sense, but it is incredibly hard. It's, you know, if you're a marketing professional and you've owned a particular channel or a particular discipline of marketing, and you're living in that discipline or channel, then that drives a certain type of behavior. So if you are a digital marketer, or if you're an SEO specialist, or if you're a MOPS, marketing operations, or MarTech professional, that you're living in that world and not thinking about the whole buying process as it comes together. You're thinking about how to optimize that one piece in isolation.
Yes, if the marketers could just think, even if you're not being told, you're not going to be told to do this, right, for the most mm-hmm. part. But if you become an expert on how the customer buys, mm-hmm. you're going to do well. And I've seen it time and again. Now, back to the American versus British English. In the book, you do use the word soccer, as I mentioned. Mm-hmm. And I think I also remember the word baton. It's no longer a baton handoff from marketing to sales, like a relay race in track. Mm-hmm. It's more like, that's why you mentioned soccer, it's more like kicking the ball back and forth constantly between sales mm-hmm. and marketing.
Yeah. I mean, it's certainly a team effort, that kind of idea of the buying process is like spaghetti, and you can't control what the customer's going to do. So it's not like suddenly the customer's now at this stage and they're only going to consume marketing channels. These things are happening in parallel, and the more consistent you can get those in terms of messaging, the more consistent you can get those in terms of the types of interactions. So for example, if you are selling to a customer and you're partway through nearly closing a deal and they get an offer that lands from marketing, suddenly the customer thinks, right, does this business even know me? What's going on here? It sort of disrupts and
yes.
eeks away. You lose trust, right, in that process. So how do you make sure that you're operating in sync and centering around accounts and clients is a great way of focusing your effort. You're treating these organizations as your markets.
Yes. And that
therefore
can
your marketing has to become more focused as well.
Absolutely. You talk about reputation, which we'll talk about in a minute. But okay, so somebody's saying, okay, Douglas, you know, smart guy, well, you know, I measure by top of the funnel, or what am I supposed to measure these people on? There's a great section from page 68 I want to quote real quickly. Marketing is designed to cram as much in at the top and expects a small percentage to convert into revenue. Our data shows less than 1% of marketing leads convert to closed won revenue, as you mentioned, and this number has been in progressive decline over the past few years. Sales teams blame a lack of leads or poor lead quality as the reason they're not hitting their quotas. There's an opportunity to stop counting leads or measuring vanity metrics and instead measure how many accounts and buying groups are progressing from one buying stage to the next. the time it's taking, and the value it's adding to the deal size. This provides a more meaningful view of the value that sales and marketing activities are providing to their clients. One other question about that section. What is creepy personalization? You mentioned this a couple times in the book. Creepy personalization.
We've all had it. It's where something is your name has been added multiple times, or your company logo has just been stuck on something, or somebody has seen that you've clicked on a social ad and they reference that social ad. It's like you're being stalked or followed, and it shows up in the communication. There's no benefit to it. It may as well not even be there. Creeps me out.
Someone once said, "We saw that you opened that email."
Yeah. Like, and immediately you're on the back foot thinking, well, what else are you tracking? I think, again, you know, going back to trust, it's all about trust. Creepy personalization doesn't build trust. In fact, it's quite the opposite. But there's so much personalization technology out there. There's so much in the way of tooling. We've all got phenomenal amounts of data, and our ability to tailor based on data, and given the appetite to do more for less, quite often your marketing is seen as the engine to be able to, you know, 10x, 100x what the sales and business development effort. So creepy personalization sneaks in many, many cases.
Yes, and that brings to mind what you mentioned earlier from that technology firm CEO who said, mm-hmm. reputation yep. is earned in droplets mm-hmm. and lost mm-hmm. in bucket loads.
Exactly.
And that's a good example of how ABM, when done badly, can actually worsen mm-hmm. your reputation.
Yeah.
I want to jump ahead to something you touched on earlier. I think it's going to just upset a lot of marketing people. They need to hear it. Or a lot of marketing people will say, yes, I know. I face that challenge all the time. And that was from page 93. Where off to the side, I wrote the word yikes with an exclamation point. One challenge we see frequently is in how well suppliers position themselves to clients. Our Momentum ITSMA Client Buying Index tells us that vendors are quickly ruled out if their messaging is unclear or their proposition is confusing. Around 40% of companies are ruled out purely because the stakeholder doesn't understand their proposition at a glance. And I got to believe that includes just looking at their homepage.
Yeah, I mean, there's just so many providers out there, right? The market is diverse, and you know, there are lots of options to fix a problem, address a particular need. So many organizations just go out to market with something that looks shiny, or they want to try and grow, but actually when it comes down to it, it's how valuable is this? Does this really connect with your customers and the language they're using?
Mm-hmm. And I think it's a lot more work for organizations mm-hmm. to get that than they realize.
Yep.
So it's easy for me to state that and explain it, but it's really, really difficult. But those that do, it seems to pay big dividends. And then even jumping all the way to the end of the book, you write, we know that when sales and marketing teams struggle to articulate their value to a client, the road to revenue often ends up nowhere.
Yeah.
Oh, my goodness. And then jumping ahead, these are all the things that either made me laugh or got me emotionally involved.
Got you fired up.
Yes, it's got me fired up. You wrote a drama here. Okay, so I had to laugh at the thing on page 103 about how not to build relationships. And it includes tactics like spamming, never heard of it, or spray and pray, which I mentioned earlier. And then there are these two things where, I'm just going to quote them, page 104, you write, where organizations fail is when they end up with surface-level relationships that are tactical. They have endless lunches or coffee meetings with contacts and don't go deeper in the ways covered throughout this book. And then you write, random acts of engagement don't work, such as having the occasional event here or a client dinner there. And I'm guessing you must see quite a bit of that.
Yeah, I mean, for sure. It happens all the time, doesn't it? Of our pipelines drying up. Let's have a quick round table and fix it.
Yeah, panic. Do something.
versus a sustained effort of these are our customers. This is how we're adding value to their business. And this is how we're creating a win-win for our organization in terms of our growth, but also for our clients.
Yeah.
In terms of the value that's being delivered.
Well, I want to quote from page 108 here, just jumping ahead, because I appreciate how generous you're being with your time, and quote from this and ask you to fill in the blank. Page 108, you don't need to look at it, but I know you're not going to know the answer. Preference for the status quo and competition are significant obstacles in the buying cycle, but there is a more menacing and difficult to defeat obstacle that teams must contend with. Alicia Linden, what is that?
Inability to make a decision.
My biggest competitor.
I mean, just not being able to say, yes, we're going to do this, whether it's yes, we're going to move forward, or we all agree. And I think we've seen lots of transformations just fail, as in big investments, big flagship initiatives just not play out.
Is it on the increase?
I think in the run-up to COVID, it was really on the increase of big projects just not working out. And now we're certainly seeing this caution, this level of, you know, there's more options I could take, which one is the right one? Mm-hmm. And actually, I'm just better off not getting to a decision and kicking the can down the road. I think also 10-year in roles, given the kind of volatility and you know, organization changes we're seeing, mm-hmm. It's also creating a different type of behavior, which is, you know, often let's not fix this now if we don't need to.
Yeah,
let's kick it down for another 6 months or another 9 months.
Well, I'm only recommending the books I think are really, really helpful, because I don't want to load up everybody's book list here. But there's another one that I think the listeners would really like as it relates to this topic. Mm-hmm. Again, an entire book written about this called The Jolt Effect.
Yes. Yeah. No, it's a great book.
Matt Dixon, who was one of the co-authors of several books, including The Challenger Customer. And it was just mind-blowing about how people are actually more fearful of making a decision than not making one. And he even talks about how salespeople actually make it worse.
Yes,
by trying to create, can you talk about how this is something that was on page 111, where you talk about how sales and marketing teams are actually unknowingly contributing to this problem?
Yeah.
Talk about that.
Some of this is about, you know, marketing showing up with one approach, organizations, you know, sales having a disconnected approach. And I think sales and marketing can. Are often saying what you're doing today, you need to do differently. So they're challenging customers' existing position. And, you know, marketing campaigns show sizzle and sales are kind of going out in battle. But actually for these cautious buyers, it's less about going, you're missing out. And we've got to win this revenue. And if you don't do this, it's much more about de-risking and helping the organization, the buyer, understand how to take these steps as stepping stones and reinforcing that decision. So it's more about risk reduction and helping to build that consensus. So really equipping your relationships with enough of the right value and clarity of thought that they can take into other stakeholders to get people on board.
It's an interesting topic. That was one of my favorite sections of the book about the indecisive buyer, what's going on there. And there's some real fear. I mean, I would be afraid too. You know, you think about it, if you buy the wrong car, you buy the wrong, roofing job.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
That's on you. But if you make the wrong decision for your enterprise company, that's on your future ability to make money. It puts the company at risk. It's a much, much more emotional purchase. And I'm sorry, but there's another author in London, Paul Cash, who wrote Humanizing B2B. And they talk in the entire book about why not talking about what's involved from an emotional standpoint is a big mistake.
Yep.
So I want to quote from page 125, where you write, account-based marketing is about people, not personas. Accounts, not markets. It shifts the focus from the broadcast of, let me tell you why we are great, to the value of, we see your problems and opportunities for growth. Let us help you get there. I hope everyone caught the difference there. What are some of the telltale signs that a company will be successful implementing ABM versus those that are going to have trouble? In other words, what does good look like and what does not so good start to look like? You've probably seen this lots of times.
Yes, certainly. I mean, it's a regular conversation. I think where organizations don't succeed is where this stays as the exact same marketing processes as you would use to deliver a broadcast campaign or apply to a set of accounts. And it's delivered by marketing as a standalone mm-hmm. set of channels, mm-hmm. essentially, into those customers. We have a pyramid that we developed a little while ago, the kind of one-to-one, one-to-few, one-to-many. And what ends up happening is organizations try and group accounts together to get some level of scale, and then end up not really talking to the needs of those clients. They're not really leveraging any of that account insight. They're not drawing on any of that joining of the dots of messaging. So I think the single biggest point of failure is where ABM is more traditional marketing campaigns dressed up because it's account targeting. I think the second point is, you know, where organizations will be unclear on their accounts and not have a view that these are accounts they're investing in. So they're expecting almost, if I can target these accounts for a quarter, I'm going to drive up revenue growth next month in these customers. So selecting the wrong accounts to begin with, investing in the wrong accounts, right. Not prioritizing focus in the right accounts. So, you know, we get the flip side of that challenge where organizations spend a long time on their top 10 customers and they're already their biggest customers. And actually they've already maxed out their share of wallet. Right. And they're in reputation protection mode. And then they kind of question overall performance. So account prioritization will be the second. And then the third area is really around the language that and that integration really between sales and marketing mm-hmm. and some of the execs as it relates to developing these accounts. What we often see is marketing is added as, you know, a page in the account plan or whatever marketing activities running is separate to an account plan itself. And these things should all be integrated. It sounds obvious, but really hard to do in yes. in practice, particularly when you've got customers where conversation is happening and things are moving and you've got a one-to-one partner, client, owner, sales relationship with a customer and marketing are resourced in a very different way.
Yes, and that's what I found so interesting about Bev Burgess's book on account-based growth. She mm-hmm. didn't talk about marketing until about the 10th chapter. In other words, mm-hmm. she was talking about getting the organization in the right mindset and aligned in order for the marketing to work well. So if readers took only one thing away from the book, what would you hope it would be?
That it's all about your customers and helping them to navigate the buying process. It's all about adding value to those customers. So really focus in on your customers, what they need rather than what you want to sell and market.
Yes. And that's probably one of my biggest takeaways from reading over 500 sales and marketing books. Just focus on the customer, which is the hardest thing for companies to do.
Sounds obvious, but I think the yes. ability to be able to live and breathe and talk the customer language when you have so much of your own Kool-Aid.
Yes.
Your own organization initiatives, there's different things going on across the business. How do you do that in a way that, it stays in step and cuts through that noise for your own customers?
Absolutely. Well, let's give the listener something to do, some homework. What's one thing a listener could do today to put in action one of the ideas from your book to get them sort of thinking in the right direction?
Probably my number one thing for a marketer to do tomorrow would be to go and talk to a customer.
Yes!
Meet a customer. I mean, that would give gives a very great insight. The more marketers can do that, the better. And I think it would just make all of marketing more account-centric. That would be my top recommendation.
I couldn't agree more. Don't take my word for it, folks. Listen to these authors. They're saying it too. So, well, beside Don and Martha's book, looking back, what books have most inspired your working career?
Don and Martha are definitely up there. There's probably a couple of others. I mean, there's so many to mention. I love Dan Pink's book, To Sell Is Human.
Yes.
I think so many marketeers, sellers, you know, that they hate the word selling and this idea that it's intrinsic in our society and it's something to be celebrated and it's not seen as this thing that happens in isolation over there. It's a big part of everybody and we are all human. I love Dan Pink's thinking and got a lot from that book.
He's a great author.
And then David C. Baker, who wrote the book, The Business of Expertise.
Oh, yeah.
You know, really love
that was on the show a few years ago, yeah.
Wasn't it? Great. Mm-hmm. Love his writing style. Yeah, I just think that particular book helps. Quite often firms just want to go out and capture the market and be mass market. And I like his thinking on operating in a niche and really building your expertise.
Yes, and you know, when you were talking about evidence-based thought leadership earlier, his book came to mind. He writes on all kinds of blogs and so forth, but he writes on LinkedIn, and you really know he knows what he's talking about.
Yes. Oh, yeah. Wonderful. Yeah. Every time it's a value exchange for sure.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Fabulous.
At marketingbookpodcast.com, we're going to include links to everything linkable, including all the books that have been mentioned or the interviews, your site, your LinkedIn profile, and so forth. And now a word to you, dear listener. Please reach out to Alicia. Congratulate her on this very emotional book for me. Thank her for being a guest on the Marketing Book Podcast. If nothing else, share this interview on LinkedIn and tag us so you could win a copy of the book and I can thank you. And if you're listening on your smartphone and you've subscribed to the Marketing Book Podcast on your favorite podcast app like Apple Podcasts, all of these links can be found by going to this episode right now and clicking on this episode's website link. Final quote, page 7. I hope you utilize this book to go beyond the ABM buzzword. Instead, create a lasting effect in how you win, retain, and grow strategic clients and develop a client-focused organizational culture to outperform the market. The book is The ABM Effect, How to Win, Retain, and Grow Valuable Clients for Market-Beating Growth. The author is Alicia Linden. Alicia, thank you very much for joining us on the Marketing Book Podcast.
Really great to have been with you. Thanks so much for the conversation. It's the best podcast I've ever been on, Douglas.
Oh, thank you so much.
Can you dig it?
This Valentine's Day, Dunkin's got the perfect pairings to show your love. So get down on one knee with a dozen brownie batter donuts and a cocoa mocha signature latte. Or make them swoon with a strawberry dragon fruit Dunkin' refresher with a Cupid's Choice donut. Are you ready for love? America runs on Dunkin'. Price and participation may vary. Limited time offer.